From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Hayden Rookley is a professor at Brown University School of Public Health and an Oregon attorney. Thank you, Hayden, for being on the Oregon Grapevine.
Thanks so much for having me.
To me, and I think other lay users of the healthcare system, maybe professional users of the healthcare system, it looks like a mess. And it can be really difficult to get a doctor and really difficult to navigate. Let's start there. Is it going to stay a mess? What's your perspective on healthcare now?
Well, hopefully it won't stay a mess, but I would agree with the assessment that today is the U.S. healthcare system, as many can, I think, understand today, is extraordinarily expensive and has been for decades. We jump off the charts compared to our peer nations in terms of how much we collectively spend in the healthcare system, and it's long been understood that we don't get a whole lot for it. And one of those dimensions of performance is a lack of access to healthcare services. This has become particularly a problem in primary care. And in Oregon, like many places across the country, a lot of folks just have difficulty finding a physician and being able to access that physician.
It can seem to me as a user and my friends as users that a primary driving force is that doctors kind of go into it. Some of them go into it because they want to make money. And so being a primary care doc might not be as lucrative as being an orthopedic surgeon or some other specialty. And so therefore, why would I be a GP? Is that just a cynical outlook or is there truth to that?
No, there are a number of drivers here, but that's a big one. The U.S. for, again, kind of decades has failed to invest in primary care like it does other specialties. And the primary way that we finance the healthcare system today is through reimbursement policy. So U.S. healthcare system is overwhelmingly taxpayer financed. Roughly 60-70% of the system, as I mentioned, is financed by taxpayers, the bulk of which comes from reimbursement or paying physicians for services, paying other providers for services that they deliver. And the primary care for decades has long been undervalued in terms of what it gets paid. This is one of the key drivers that pushes a lot of physicians to pursue other specialties instead of, as you mentioned, going into GP or primary care and providing services that way.
My particular primary care doc is in a group that used to be kind of independently owned. It's now moved to a corporation. It's still relatively small and better than some that I think there are out there. What about the system of corporatization of medicine? And is that the absolute wave of the future? Or I'm imagining and hoping that some are friendlier and better than others, but I'd love to know your take on that.
Corporatization or corporate consolidation of the healthcare system is not an inevitability. We certainly don't have to organize our healthcare system that way, but through a series of policy decisions we've made, again, kind of over the decades, the system has tended in that direction. So as you mentioned, this example of a primary care physician or your local medical practice having once been independent, now being part of a larger corporate entity, is consistent with the trend we've seen for years now. The prior model of physicians having independent practice was very common. Certainly, you know, if we go back to kind of like the mid-century days, but all the way through really the last couple decades. Since then, we've seen physicians become increasingly employed by hospitals and by other corporate entities, as opposed to having an ownership share, being part of a private, private practice or be part of a community health center or a publicly owned clinic. The majority of physicians today, around 70 to 80%, are employed by, as I said, either a hospital system or a corporate entity like an insurance company or like a private equity investor. And that's the system we have as of now. It is certainly where the status quo is, but it is, as we can talk about a little bit today, there are a lot of states, federal policymakers as well, are starting to question this model and think about ways that we might organize the system differently and might enable physicians to have their own practices or to practice in community health centers or publicly owned community clinics. Other ownership models are certainly possible, but we have to establish kind of the policy framework to allow that to flourish.
I want to get to insurance and that whole maelstrom, for lack of a better word at the moment. But first, I'd like to follow up on what you just said, which seems optimistic. How do you create those systems, or what are you, as you're embroiled in this system and these conversations, are you optimistic? And what are some of the creative ideas for moving away from corporatization and having a more humanely based operating system?
I'll throw out two interesting policy levers here. The first is certainly relevant to Eugene and relevant to Oregonians, and that's the corporate practice of medicine or the ban on the corporate practice of medicine. States traditionally have actually prohibited corporations like private equity investors, like insurance companies from owning medical practices. And have long actually required that those medical practices are either community-owned clinics, publicly owned clinics, as I've mentioned here, or if they're for-profit clinics, that they're actually owned by licensed physicians and other clinicians in the state, stemming from this long-standing concern that for-profit investor-backed medical practices with a fiduciary duty to maximize their profits might engage in certain operational decisions that could undermine or not be in the best interest of patients in their pursuit of generating a profit. Whereas physician and other clinician-owned practices might have more of a restraint on some of those business practices because not only are they in the community and in the practice, but they also have a strong professional and ethical obligation to put their patients over all else. So most states over the last number, again, over the last really like 50 or 60 years, or dating back that far, had these laws on the books that said that these practices have to be owned by licensed physicians. In the last few decades, as part of a general shift towards a more market orientation in terms of how we govern our healthcare system, these laws have been eroded either through repeal or in most cases, actually just a lack of enforcement. Again, a lack of enforcement of this idea that we want practices owned and operated by licensed clinicians. And states, including Oregon, are starting to re-examine those laws. Oregon passed one in 2025, essentially trying to update and strengthen this ban on the corporate practice of medicine to make it more difficult for physician practices to use, or excuse me, to corporate-owned practices to use certain sophisticated sort of legal tactics to own medical practices, even or functionally own medical practices, even though in Oregon and many other states, these laws are still on the books actually that prohibit corporations from owning medical practices. So there are laws like these that can be used that again create sort of the guardrails of how healthcare is organized and make certain decisions about who we want owning and controlling medical practices. And then the kind of other aspect of this is around back to kind of financing policy and how we make decisions about how the system is financed and how physicians and providers are reimbursed. For years, we've had this system in which medical providers can earn a lot more money if they are part of a larger institution. And this is just basic dynamics of negotiating leverage. If you are a large entity like a hospital system, or you are part of a big private equity roll-up of practices, your leverage is much stronger when you negotiate with insurance companies for the fees you get paid to see a patient. And that's been one of these kind of systematic drivers towards consolidation to these large corporate system, because there's such an advantage if I'm a physician to being big, just because I can get a higher fee for when I see a patient. Whereas if I'm smaller, I don't have that negotiating leverage. Now that's a decision for how we again, how we organize healthcare markets and how we finance the system. We can imagine a world, and this operates today in certain sectors of the healthcare system, where the reimbursement is the same, irrespective of size. And that would be a sort of policy decision that would enable smaller practices, smaller entities to exist because they're competing, so to speak, on a more level playing field.
Not to dig deeply into the weeds, but there, of course, has been a recent lawsuit in Eugene that had to do with this, and emergency room physicians at one of the regional hospitals, local hospitals. There isn't a hospital in Eugene, but Springfield Hospital, that sounds like it is exactly this case in terms of the, well, you can explain it better than I can, but the emergency room docs basically were taken over and it turned into a problem. So could you use, without too deeply into it, I'd love for you to explain that particular case because I think it illustrates what you've just said.
Absolutely. In this case, directly related to these bans on the corporate practice of medicine I discussed in some recent legislation in Oregon, I personally had the privilege of representing the plaintiffs here, the emergency physicians who were a group of physicians and other clinicians who had been staffing the emergency room for 40 years at the local nonprofit hospital system, Peace Health. And the executives at Peace Health, after years of growing friction between the physicians and hospital management, which we can get into the history if we want to, of issues in Eugene and access to primary care and emergency room services. But nonetheless, the Peace Health made the decision to part ways with the local physician group, which again had been staffing the ER in a contract between Peace Health and Eugene Emergency Physician for decades, and decided to try to bring in a staffing company, an investor-owned staffing company out of Georgia that promised to come in and employ and hire a bunch of physicians and staff the ER for ostensibly provide more efficient care or something better to Peace Health that they found to be more attractive, or potentially just find a different entity to manage these physicians with whom the relationship had soured. Our clients, our physicians in this case, we brought a lawsuit challenging this decision directly in the wake of Oregon's 2025 bill updating its ban on the corporate practice of medicine. So again, Oregon has long had this prohibition on corporations owning medical practices and employing physicians. And that law was strengthened in 2025 to make sure it's enforced against, various models that these corporations use to kind of get around the law. And what became very clear in this when Peace Health made this decision was that Apollo MD, which was this corporate staffing company that was going to come in to replace the physicians, was likely operating illegally because they were operating in this common scheme that the 2025 legislation tried to prohibit. And this is a scheme in which essentially medical practices are functionally owned by separate corporate entities known as management companies. They are used to functionally control medical practices, even though on paper they don't look like they're controlled by investor-owned companies. This is one of these pervasive workarounds that makes it look like corporations are complying with these bans on corporate practice of medicine, but in reality, they actually aren't. So the whole purpose of the legislation was to try to prohibit this common workaround that, I'll state it one more time, allows for corporations to functionally own medical practices, even though that's prohibited in the state. So on that basis, we brought suit against the Peace Health and Apollo MD for operating in this model after this bill had been passed, and after nearly 5 days of a hearing in federal court on a preliminary injunction motion that we brought to try to stop this staffing transition. The defendants here, Apollo and Peace Health, decided to back out. And Peace Health decided to re-engage our clients, re-engage EEP, and bring them back in the emergency physicians. and instead of trying to go forth with this new staffing company that was almost certainly operating illegally under Oregon's new law.
So congratulations are in order to you and to the doctors.
Thank you.
It brings me to the question of unions. I know it seems a little tangential, but certainly nurses' unions and labor unions for nurses are something we hear about a lot. They go on strike, or they're involved, or they have agreements. I don't hear so much, although in this, I don't know that these doctors are members of a union, but I'd love to know how that works in terms of labor conversations and doctors. And part of me bristles a little at the idea of what would seemingly be high-paid professionals and why would they need a union? But at the same time, I'd love to have a little bit of your insight into where are those conversations? Are there doctors' unions? Should there be? Where's it going?
There are increasingly doctors' unions. Some of my work, I've done some empirical work actually studying this phenomenon. And since the COVID pandemic, there has been a significant rise in unionization amongst physicians. And the Northwest is actually a relative hotbed for this activity. The physicians that we were representing in the EEP case, while they were staffing the emergency room, they were their own independent medical. So not actually employed by the directly employed by the hospital, which is a condition for unionization. However, as I mentioned earlier, most physicians are now employed by some sort of corporate entity, and the largest employer is the hospital. So this is one of the sea changes we've seen in the profession over the decades. Most physicians being employed by hospital systems. And they, as well as particular residents, so physicians in training, have taken up unionization as a way to try to push back against what is commonly known as this sense of corporatization, or as I write in some of my work, this concept of financialization, the financialization of the US healthcare system, whether it's in nonprofits or for-profit corporations, where to put it, I think, succinctly, the endeavor of making money, of turning a profit, has often become, like many sectors of our economy, the primary goal of corporations, rather than a byproduct of delivering a good service or goods to consumers or to patients. And again, in the healthcare setting, I think there's a sense that the bottom line has kind of become primary. And this becomes felt by not just patients and communities, but I think very much so by the clinicians who treat patients. And decisions are made without their involvement. This was the case in EEP, without physicians' involvement. There are all sorts of governance decisions that are made about how a hospital or another entity runs that feel like the bottom line is just driving decision making and doesn't include those who are closest to actually delivering patient care. And I think this is a one of the key drivers of unionization and the broader problem of what's sometimes called moral injury or alienation of not just nurses and other clinicians, but also of physicians. And this is where it's a quite fascinating phenomenon because you have physicians who, as a general profession, are the highest paid profession in the United States. And while it is probably the case, well, it is to be the case that physicians who are lower paid are more likely to be unionizing, I don't think the primary driver here is actually their income. I think and this is what I've found in some of my work, and this is certainly comports with what I've seen anecdotally. Much of this is a sense that there's a real friction today between why they got into medicine and their professional and ethical obligations to their patients and to deliver good care is often in tension with the institutions with for whom they work. And there's a real sense that they have been disempowered in terms of, as I mentioned, kind of the governance. And decision making in the institution are subject to all sorts of decisions that seem to be contrary to what their patients need, yet good for the executives or the bottom line. So in this sense, while you have, physicians as again, a very well compensated and highly respected profession, sensing what so many professions have felt over the decades in this country as we move towards a more kind of financialized, or in the healthcare sense, kind of corporatized system, that there needs to be some sort of collective action to try to safeguard, to try to hold on to some level of power that can be exercised against management to make sure that physicians have a level of protection and control over their practice of medicine, their trade. And as I mentioned, I think that the sense of that professional autonomy and control over their work and the purpose and the reason they get into the job often gets sacrificed when they work for these large corporatized institutions that make them feel like they're just kind of a cog in a big machine. And I think that's why you've seen increasingly the move towards, hey, all sorts of things. So corporate practice of medicine is one kind of policy push. Unionization is another. Hey, if we're going to be employed here, let's band together collectively. Let's lock arms also with other clinicians, other nurses who are doing the same thing, and see if, as clinicians together, as caretakers together, we can exercise within our hospital or institution more of this power to protect, our profession, our work, and ultimately, our patients.
I know people who say, my doctor only now spends 10 or 15 minutes with me. It's not like it used to be. They come in, but they're being forced to kind of go this treadmill of medical care. And therefore, for instance, my last primary care doc went to what? To a concierge practice, because somehow that seemed like a better thing. So I'd love, is that happening? First of all, maybe define what that is. Maybe it's my word and there's some politically better word than concierge medicine, but I'd love to talk about that, or have you talk about that phenomena a little bit and how that works, because it sounds to me like it's related to exactly this, that the doctor's trying to get more into what he or she really wants to be doing.
Absolutely. So this phenomenon of concierge medicine, sometimes it's referred to as direct primary care. Other forms of physicians essentially throwing their hands up, primary care physicians, and saying, I can't operate in the system anymore. And I'm just going to get out of the general system of insurance and start my own practice, directly bill patients, typically ask them for a fee that allows them a monthly fee that the patient pays directly to the physician, and I'll just see patients that way. And this, in my view, is not a comprehensive solution and raises some concerns, particularly those of equity. A lot of folks don't have the resources to pay a physician monthly to see them. There are questions about access because oftentimes when physicians go into these models, they are seeing a lot fewer patients. So when we're thinking about this broader question of access, where does this leave the rest of the system? With those caveats, I completely understand why physicians are making this decision. And oftentimes they're doing this understanding that there are trade-offs here and they might not be able to see all the patients that they want to be able to. And they might not be able to make it work for any patient at any income level, but they nonetheless make the calculation that everybody needs care. And me being able to provide good care to a certain subset of patients is better than I'd be able to do as, again, a kind of cog in this machine. And I think, again, it's a testimony to how bad we've allowed the system to get, how much we've allowed primary care to wither on the vine, to where we have the system today, where we have a total inadequacy of supply of primary care physicians, and we force them to operate in an incredibly complicated regulatory environment where, one, they are dealing with, for about half their patients have private insurance, and this is a total morass of regulations from private insurance companies, different prior authorization requirements. Each insurance company has its different billing requirements, different requirements for reimbursement, different requirements for how they use medical electronic records. This creates just a substantial amount of administrative burden. And then we also have on the private insurance side of, or excuse me, the public insurance side of things, so Medicare and Medicaid, which covers about the other half of patients. It too has become incredibly complicated. We've privatized most of these programs. So folks who are on public Medicare or Medicaid, the majority of them actually have some form of a private insurer doing this. So again, this adds layers onto bureaucracy for physician practices, because even with their patients who are in basic public programs, those are actually being administered through private insurers. The rules of those public programs themselves have gotten more onerous in terms of the various quality reporting and other things that physicians have to do, primary care especially. And so we find ourselves in a position where reimbursement and payment policy to get paid for the work you do has become incredibly complex and saddled with all sorts of burdens from both public and private insurance programs. And couple that with a lack of capacity and the relatively low pay of this specialty versus others, primary care is getting to the point where it is untenable. I have trouble finding primary care physicians who feel like they can do their work at full time. So you're seeing so many of these physicians go down to less than one FTE or simply tap out of the system entirely and go to these concierge type models. It's absolutely one of the symptoms of this broader problem of corporatization, of demoralization of the physicians, of the profession, and a primary care infrastructure that is really in disrepair.
Do you have words of positive angle or positive looking at, do you feel like things are going to get better? There's this huge morass that we've talked about and we barely touched. We could keep going in a very interesting way, much deeper. And yet I find myself, as I often do, how do you make it better? What can be done? Do you see solutions and people who are saying, no, this really matters, and in fact, we're fixing it?
Yeah, I do. I think the series of events that's happened in Oregon around corporate practice of medicine, I think, offer some promise. There's an example of where folks on the policymaking side of things got together and said, we don't like this trend of corporatization. We want to do something about it and pass the law. And then a year later, you saw its enforcement through the courts and the protection of a local democratic physician-owned group be able to stay and staff their emergency room. And that, I think, is an example of the success that at the state level, there can be wins, there can be progress here. I think more broadly, and I should mention, there are good policies being pushed in a number of different states that are pushing back against the specific issue of corporatization. The more systemic solution is going to require more ambitious policy solutions that kind of address this more offensive side of things. Like we've kind of referred to corporate practice of medicine as a good example of some defense. We want to prohibit certain entities from maybe exercising too much control over physician practice. We still have this problem of like, how are we financing the system and are we building the sort of capacity to have abundant primary care, let's just say, for all Americans, which is certainly within the capability of the world's most prosperous nation. This is something we can have if I think we fight for it and can achieve it. Of course, this all has to be done through politics. And things are probably going to get worse before they get better in our healthcare system. The Trump administration is hell-bent on slashing the Medicaid program, consistent with what the Trump administration did last time, what so many Republican administrations have done from a kind of policy perspective, is certainly in my life, they've slashed the social state, they've slashed healthcare programs, and they've instead, they've used those quote unquote savings to finance tax cuts for rich people and corporations and to build up the military state. And that, of course, is exactly what we're seeing in the Trump administration right now. The ICE, the military terrorizing so many people domestically, and so much money going to these foreign wars that we're financing to terrorize and wreak havoc in other countries, most notably in Gaza and in Palestine. That's a political decision. And there is a possibility, certainly, I am hopeful that Americans decide that we want a different cast of leaders and different folks who will have different policy priorities. And we've certainly seen over the last number of decades, every few decades, there's sort of an opportunity for usually Democrats to make some decisions or to do some sort of big healthcare reform policy. The Affordable Care Act was the last one. I think the hopeful version of this story is that Democrats can regain power at the federal level and reverse so much of this damage that the Trump administration is creating on the Medicaid side of things. So Oregon, like many states, is going to sustain significant losses from the federal level to finance its Medicaid system. And hopefully there is appetite to not only restore financing of our Medicaid system, but pursue some more ambitious policy that can simultaneously wrap our arms around the affordability crisis in the US healthcare system where it costs so much, and make a couple of key decisions that might move towards investing in the types of care capacity, types of community-owned, physician-owned care capacity that we want to see. A sort of, I've talked about a sort of industrial policy for primary care. Right now, our industrial policy in this system is to essentially build a bunch of data centers. And we're seeing this in Oregon in particular as well. That, again, policy decision. We certainly have the financial and economic capabilities to build healthcare capacity, but it's going to take, just like it did in Oregon with this, small bill around corporate practice of medicine, this takes all of us collectively fighting for that through the political process. I certainly think it's possible. I'm hopeful that we're going to see a backlash to the fascism of this administration. It could certainly go worse and in the other direction. But as part of that backlash, I'm hoping that a key part of this agenda will be to reinvest for the first time, adequately invest in the things we care about. Like, are we investing in science at the federal level and the NIH? Are we investing in our public, insurance programs? And are we thinking about, again, organizing the healthcare system in a way that can actually meet people's needs?
How did you get to this topic is a small word for it, but this piece of your life work, how did you come to medical issues as you realized as an attorney where you wanted to go, and what inspires you to do this work?
I've been fascinated with our healthcare system for decades now. I remember succinctly my parents taking me down to the Bijou, the movie theater down in Eugene, and watching a Michael Moore movie and learning, I was probably in high school, that 50 million Americans don't have health insurance. And that sort of just shocked my conscience. I actually just couldn't believe it. And that was one of a few formative memories for me that started down the path of trying to understand why this was. Shortly after that, I went to college. This was around the time of the Affordable Care Act, which was a step forward in our healthcare system that mitigated the level of uninsurance that we have, but was nonetheless a very complicated piece of legislation. So it drew me in further intellectually to try to understand the healthcare system. And since then, I have been on this kind of this journey of curiosity and try and understanding of how can we organize this system in a better way. I think simultaneously, I personally, just like so many folks, have had my interactions with the healthcare system and different times, different scary times in my life where I've really needed care and felt the vulnerability that one feels when they go to a when they see a physician. And I think from those experiences, I've always been just touched by people who decide as their profession, as their life's work, to treat patients and to take care of others. And I think as I understand the system more and more, and as I see the system move in a direction that undermines that desire for people to care for patients, to decide to go on a profession that that's what they do, as I see that becoming harder and harder, and I see forces of profiteering, of the financialization I discussed, seem to erode those sort of professional ethics and those commitments, it inspires me to do more of this work and to think harder and try to work with others to try to figure out how do we preserve that such, like, I think, beautiful and benevolent spirit of medicine, the taking care of folks. How do we create a system that allows that nurtures that and allows it to flourish? And I think so much of our healthcare system has gone in the other direction. And I think about a lot of my work as how do we resist those trends and again create a system that is encouraging and that is nurturing the sort of the best angels of so many of the clinicians who again devote their lives to the very simple yet heroic endeavor of taking care of people when when they're most vulnerable and when they need it most.
Thank you so much for this overview and conversation. I know we could go deeper, and I hope that we maybe get a chance to. But Hayden Rook Lay, professor and advocate, and thank you for being on the Oregon Grapevine and giving of your time.
Happy to do it anytime.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.